You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Dr. Andrew Lustig. He's president and founder of Global Outreach Doctors. Welcome back.
Hey there. Thank you for having me.
It's always good to have you, although the topics that we're talking about are reminders of what a difficult place this world is. You send people into conflict zones, essentially, or post-conflict zones where doctors are needed, or places where there are refugees. I think the last time you were here, we were talking about the refugees in Bangladesh. And today we're going to be talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo. What's going on in Congo? What are you sending people in for?
Well, a little background, Mary Charlotte. The Democratic Republic of Congo has been known for a very long time to produce minerals that we use in our telephones and our computers. Cobalt is a conflict mineral that is mined by children and underserved individuals. The Congo is also more recently known for being the rape capital of the world, as identified by a New York Times reporter. It's also known through the UN as one of the worst places in the world to be a woman. And we sent a assessment team to the Congo upon the request of a local partner, Nima Namadamu. Nima reached out to us and said, I've been working in the Congo for a very long time. I am a sexual gender-based violent advocate, and we would like your doctors and nurses to help us with the trauma facing the victims of SGBV.
SGBV.
Sexual gender-based violence.
Got it. And so it's funny to say the words a gender-based violence advocate. It's sort of an anti-violence advocate, but I know what you're saying. The kinds of things going on there, some of them are sort of too horrible to recount, but give us a sense of what we're talking about.
Sure. The Congo has something like 56 million people. Assuming that half of those, and according to statistics, half of those are women. Most all women in the country and girls have been somewhat affected by sexual gender-based violence, either directly or indirectly, through their families, through their friends. So we're talking about 20-some-odd million people. The DRC has had some more recent notoriety for Ebola. Ebola affects a few thousand people. It's important. It gets a lot of attention. You'll see it on CNN. Contrary to that, you do not see much about the violence that has been going on for many decades there against women. And it's something that does not get treated in most underserved nations. Mental health is low on the totem pole in the United States. It's getting better. People realize it is a disease, but certainly in developed nations, there's probably, 60 psychiatrists for the entire country.
Undeveloped or underdeveloped nations?
Yeah. But, particularly in the DRC, there's something like 60 mental health providers for the entire population. And what happens is that you have these women that have physical and mental results of the violence. And Dr. Dennis Mukwege, who won the Nobel Prize in 2018, is known as the top surgeon for sexual gender-based violence victims. So he is dealing with the physical results of that violence. Our team went in to look at not only the medical issues, but primarily the mental health issues that have been affecting these women, the trauma.
So what kinds of situations are you seeing? What kinds of traumas specifically are you looking at?
What we found is that, you know, we went to many hospitals, clinics. We worked with the Methodist Church, who has a very well-established group of clinics. And we went to basically areas where these people go for treatment. And what we found is that many of the victims of this mental health trauma somaticize it by saying, I have a headache, I have migraines, I have a stomach ache. And the doctors there were treating the stomach ache, the headache, you know, pain management, essentially. But our team, of course, realized that those were real or not real, but the main contributor was the trauma from being raped, the trauma from watching a daughter being raped, the trauma from men being raped. And so what our team did was work with the medical providers in the local community to let them know that that actually wasn't the cause, that the headache wasn't something that necessarily needed to be treated, but that the mental health causing the headache needed to be treated. And our team brought with them a scalable test that allows questions to be asked to determine where this person's trauma level is, to be scored, essentially. And the local providers really didn't have this tool. So the first thing of any disease, the first really need, is to identify it. And so with mental health, there's a scoring system. And so we provided that tool and worked with the local providers.
Once you use a scoring tool, what kind of things do the scores tell you?
It's a very detailed questionnaire. The tool tells you, I mean, there are specific questions. What happened to you? Where did it happen? How often? You know, what part of your body? What did you feel? And it basically lets you know at what level their depression, their trauma is. Once you identify their level of trauma and the type of trauma, you then develop a treatment program.
I would think that when you're going through that process of scoring somebody, it could be traumatic all over again to relive that as you're telling that story, because although it's a, you know, statistical tool with numbers and all of that, it's really basically a way to get somebody's narrative along the way.
Right. So I think we've discussed this in the past, that Global Outreach Doctors provides both integrative medical providers as well as medical doctors, nurses, and allopaths. So with that, and based on my background, we look at the whole human being. And those words that come out of that person's mouth to describe what happened is a cathartic event, though you are correct that it is somewhat reliving the event. In addition to them being interviewed, we are working on solidarity workshops, which allow groups of women and girls. And the problem, by the way, is not solely women and girls, though the majority of reported incidents are women and girls. Men and boys have been affected by this. This is a country that's been at war for 40 years. This is a tool of war. There are many factions fighting. And it is sort of taken for granted that somebody you know has been through this physical sexual violence. But, you know, it's essentially necessary for the person to move the words out of their body, either in a group setting or with an interviewer, to help them. Naturally, we don't want them to relive the trauma, but these are sort of the trade-offs. How do we treat it? We need to learn about it. How do we learn about it? They need to talk about it.
So once they do talk about it, what happens next?
So they are scored. We produced, Global Outreach Doctors produced a 35-page report from the beginning of who we sent, what we were doing, who we worked with, what the history is of this violence. So the next steps are to score the individual, to document it, and to decide on a treatment program.
So then you decide on a treatment program. Again, I mean, you're in a country, you're a small group, Global Outreach Doctors, in a country where virtually everybody is affected by sexual violence one way or another, and there are 60 psychiatrists, I think is what the number
right.
You just said. So what does a treatment program look like, and who carries it out?
So this is obviously an enormous problem that Global Outreach Doctors is part of a village. It takes a village. We will bring attention to this problem by speaking on radio shows like yours and producing a report that's distributed domestically and to the Ministry of Health in DRC and so on. And then we will provide mental health treatment through a variety of both allopathic and integrative practitioners. And we're focused in a particular region called the Itombwe region, which is south of Goma, which is quite some distance from where the Ebola crisis is. However, we'll start with one region at a time. We'll start with one group at a time. We'll start with one solidarity meeting at a time. And we'll do the best we can. One of the reasons I do this radio show is to bring awareness and to get donations to help us do our work.
I was just reading a piece the other day that was put out by Searchlight New Mexico about sex trafficking here in New Mexico, and indigenous women and girls are particularly vulnerable to that. And there are so many women and girls who really are falling through the cracks. I mean, they end up in the mental health system and then they're given antidepressants and sent away, and nobody actually asks them what's going on. I think in the Congo, people pretty much know what's going on. But then this question of what treatment looks like. I mean, it seems like here in the United States, psychiatry and mental health treatment has gone from a model of talking and interacting to the dispensation of medicine, you know, antidepressants and other kinds of psychoactive medicines. What does it look like there?
Well, you know, in treating disease anywhere, you need to remove the pathogen, right? So if you get a bee sting, you got to take the stinger out. In the DRC, for 4 decades or more, we're not going to be able to remove the cause, the pathogen. We're not going to remove the perpetrators of this violence. Through education and government intervention and large-scale NGO involvement, we can make somewhat of a difference. At the moment, we look at trauma acupuncture, allopathic, you know, psychosocial drugs, and a variety of tools to attack the problem, from solidarity workshops to antidepressants. However, these medicines on the allopathic side are expensive, not readily available. And they, of course, need to be administered for long periods of time. And that's sort of when you start looking at trauma acupuncture, which is, you know, used in the United States for all kinds of mental health issues and used in overseas. The WHO has approved it for many uses overseas. And so a combination, you sort of attack the problem from, you know, a lot of different ways because you're looking to see what the lowest hanging fruit is. And for instance, trauma acupuncture is affordable. It's trainable. There are no side effects. It's very effective. You know, we use that in the island of Lesbos, where traumatized people coming across the Aegean Sea, some of them who drowned, and we've all seen those headlines, were hysterical. And how do you calm those people down? How do you untraumatize them long enough to have a conversation, long enough to either treat them allopathically or otherwise? Trauma acupuncture, very effective, low cost, easy to train, able to be used by, you know, unskilled workers that are trained. Not that they're going to become super professional at it, but it's the beginning.
When you say trainable, that means you're taking local people and training them to be acupuncturists or to do a certain kind of acupuncture protocol or what?
So you're going to be able to train nurses and potentially doctors who can identify a problem and use very, very simple acupuncture techniques. They are not going to become, you know, a licensed acupuncture. However, there are certain treatments that they can provide because the needles that are used for acupuncture do not go deep into the body. So if they made a slight mistake, you know, there are not bad results with it. However, they're not going to become full-time practitioners. There's going to be some training. And there are, by the way, NGOs that all they do is train laymen to use this technique. And we're not proposing to do that. However, it's just one of our tools.
And apparently a pretty effective one.
Yes.
So you just said that, you know, you can't take out the pathogen. The pathogen is what's going on in society, which is that there's ongoing war, ongoing disturbance because of natural resources. And, you know, people say that sometimes it's a curse for a country to have a natural resource because people are always overrunning your country and trying to get it out from under you and pay you as little as possible. But you have this long-term and quite pervasive culture of rape. What does the, I mean, you mentioned solidarity groups. What does that look like? How are women and other victims of rape working together in solidarity, in support groups to heal themselves?
Well, Mary Charlotte, there's not that many solidarity groups because there's a stigma attached to it. And it's also because it brings groups of women together to be powerful, and the perpetrators don't want that to happen. And there have been women that have been going to be either interviewed or spoken to by authorities about their trauma, and on their way, they get raped again. And so when you gather groups of people, particularly women and girls, the perpetrators don't want those women and girls to be in numbers because that gives them power. So it's a difficult situation because you've got to protect those groups when they get together, and they're drawing attention to themselves because they advertise that, hey, let's all talk about this. But those groups basically look like sharing groups that say, hey, this is what happened to me. Did this happen to you? This is how I'm feeling. How do you feel? And there's sort of a solidarity knowing that, one, you were able to get the trauma voiced outside of your body, which is cathartic and helpful, and two, that there are other people that have been through this, and through shared experiences, maybe there's some healing.
Talk about what men and boys are going through.
You know, it's interesting. We were approached recently by a very large national publication asking us about our work, but particularly about men and boys. And their focus, since they had already done a cover story about women and girls facing sexual gender-based violence in this region, they really wanted to focus on the boys and men. It's difficult because if the majority of perpetrators creating this violence are men and some boys, to come to their rescue and say, hey, what about the gender men and boys that are affected by this? It's a double-edged sword. You know, it's difficult. But in our discussion and in our interviews, we did find men and boys that were violated. Men and boys have even a further stigma because they're supposed to be the head of households. And so less reported are men and boys. We don't really know the statistics. We certainly met men and boys that were raped by soldiers and other factions. It's the same process. They have to speak about it. They have to be scored. They have to be assessed, identified, and treated.
You've got a country where war is going on for 40 years, and you have people whose entire lives, that's all they know. Whether they're on the perpetrator, well, whether they're on the military part of it, and a lot of those military people think it is their right, their absolute right to violate whoever they want to, because they're soldiers and that's what soldiers do, or whether they're victims of this whole thing. But, you know, looking at it from the outside, you ultimately need a systemic healing for the whole society. What circumstances would it take for that to happen? Like, what would it take for that to happen?
Sometimes I've done interviews, Mary Charlotte, where I'm asked, hey, is it the government's fault? Clearly, we work with government authorities, and I don't have an opinion about whose fault it is. But clearly, authorities, I mean, there are laws in the DRC that do not let women buy contraception without permission of their husbands or a male. There are laws that do not allow women to buy real estate or homes or vote or whatever. So it's a very patriarchal society. We're talking about, you know, an enormous set of circumstances that need to change. We don't propose to have the solutions. We're doing our part.
Right, right. What are some success stories that you've witnessed or that your global outreach doctor colleagues have witnessed on the ground?
Well, with Dr. Dennis Mukwege winning the Nobel Prize in 2018, suddenly millions and millions of people became aware of a man who's dedicated his life to the victims of sexual gender-based violence in the DRC, where he lives, where he's actually operated a hospital for decades. I think first and foremost, you got to bring awareness. Then you got to bring resources. And I think it's a success to have the world understand that this man has been awarded a prize for his work on this problem. That sort of triggers NGOs and the government, the local government, to sort of recognize and say, hey, the world is seeing what's happening here. We have to do something about it. I can't point to individual success yet. We've just started the process. We need the resources to bring long-term solutions that have a defined exit plan and a remote supervision thereafter, and to raise funding for that so that we can do the training we need for the local providers to, number one, realize that that stomach ache is actually really not a stomach ache, but perpetuated by a mental health issue that needs to be treated. So once we provide these trainings and those trainers train other local providers, we start to build a system of identification and treatment.
Is Global Outreach Doctors in any way putting itself in danger or in danger because they are helping women and women are targeted in the same way you said, you know, women who start a support group, they're targeted? What about aid organizations like yours?
Global Outreach Doctors has worked in a lot of dangerous places. We worked on the front lines in Mosul, Iraq for the Battle of Mosul against ISIS and provided medical care for victims and soldiers and civilians. I would tell you that DRC is potentially one of the most dangerous places we've worked. There were times when we had to use a UN helicopter to move through the country because the roads are so dangerous. You're going to get ambushed. You're going to get kidnapped. You're going to get assaulted. There were times when our team drove in Rwanda, the neighboring country, to get further south and then came back into DRC. We didn't actually fly into DRC. Our team flew into Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, went across land to the border, and then used other transportation to get to our locations. It is a very dangerous place. We are a small organization without the resources to fully implement a high security plan that allow us to really provide care in some of these areas. And so a shameless plug, globaloutreachdoctors.org needs donations to be able to do things like have a full security team, have perimeter fencing. When we develop solidarity workshops, we need to protect the women that are going to these solidarity workshops. We need to protect the physical facility where they meet several times a week so that the violence doesn't get targeted to where there's a group of these women speaking out about it. So those are the danger issues in the DRC. You know, you are particularly a target if you're a Westerner. You are particularly a target if you're a Westerner with a stethoscope around you.
How do you work with other international organizations?
Well, we always partner. So in this particular case, we were in the DRC with our local partners who have been working in this area for a very long time, but not necessarily with the tools and medical providers from developed worlds. And so we work with local providers who ask us, who invite us to meet the Minister of Health, to meet with Dr. Dennis Mukwege, to align ourselves and partner with. There are virtually very few NGOs focused on mental health, particularly for victims of sexual gender-based violence. So I think that it takes a village, and we need to work alongside local providers and provide the training.
Has your work in Global Outreach Doctors made you see our own country differently?
You know, I think I've mentioned this before. 20 years ago, I was the CEO of a media company. 15 years ago, I became involved in humanitarian medicine. You know, I wake up every day thinking how fortunate we are. I'm sitting in a comfortable room with Mary Charlotte where it's heated and I have no violent concerns. I have a deep sense of gratitude that our availability of safety. I mean, when I was in Iraq, there wasn't 20 minutes of movement without a search. So certainly, you know, the awareness of what we have in the developed world is quite acute for me anyway.
On the other side, I would think, I mean, when I look at your work, I connect the stuff that's going on in the DRC with the sex trafficking that's going on right here in New Mexico, just as one example.
I've had interviewers and friends say, and family say, hey, how come you're not helping people right in your backyard? New Mexico has a lot of need. What about, you know, the border in Mexico, and what about the refugees there? And I'll tell you, there are great groups helping people in the United States. And there are real problems in the United States and other places, developed worlds. However, the resources available are tremendous compared to the areas that we work. In the areas that we work, we don't know if that person's going to live or die the next day. Here, they may miss a meal. And I'm not, you know, belittling important needs in the United States. It's just that, number one, there are a lot of resources, and number two, the difficulties are less.
What is your hope for Global Outreach Doctors?
Long term, we're interested in placing medical providers in training local practitioners in the regions that we work for several years at a time, and then having an exit plan, and then supervising those providers, those local providers, remotely. To place a doctor in any of these regions is quite expensive if you're going to do that for several years at a time. And to have the continuity, it's important that you do place trainers, physicians in those locations. At the moment, we're only able to use volunteer teams that can give up their lives for a few weeks at a time. Long term, and we're already beginning now with one of our missions in Ethiopia, to place a physician full-time at a clinic and several clinics at 10,000 feet to start providing training for the local medical providers in that region and to create textbooks, protocols, standard operating procedures so that that person can operate in a more efficient manner and then train others. But that's our long-term goal.
Andrew Lustig is president and founder of Global Outreach Doctors. They're on the web at globaloutreachdoctors.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Andrew.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors of the Radio Cafe, the Lannell Foundation, the Lannan Foundation, Lenzic Performing Arts Center, Southwest Care, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks so much for making this program possible. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the Santa Fe Institute, a world-renowned research hub offering free online courses in the science of complex systems. Check out their community lecture series and summer science festival in Santa Fe. More at santafe.edu. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.